The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Nice to be with you. It's a subject that hopefully it'll keep you interested. If you're anything like me, it's one of your favourite subjects, talking about you. And as Arthur said, we're talking about who am I. So the first half of what I want to say will be involving the slides up on the screen behind me. And I want to look at some trends in society that I believe make it difficult to know who you are. And then in the second half, I'll present what I understand to be the Christian answer to the puzzle of personal identity. And that's when the texts in the handout will be of some help. Certainly there's one piece of advice you hear in all sorts of contexts today, whether in the self-help manuals or at school principals talking to their kids, in all sorts of ways, and it's this: be true to yourself. To disagree with it's almost unthinkable, and most people think it's about the best advice you can give. Michael Clark, for example, said it when he was discussing his tattoos in a Sunday newspaper. The pop star Rihanna talked about being true to yourself when she was discussing what she was wearing or not wearing in one of her music videos. And then Dr. Seuss's eponymous Cat in the Hat said it well: be who you are and say what you feel. Mariah Carey said it, Oprah Winfrey said it, Ellen DeGeneres said it very well. My advice to you is to be true to yourself and everything will be fine. Said that at a university convocation in New Orleans, I believe. Now, I think the problem with being true to yourself is you have to know who you are. And there's every reason to think that knowing who you are is harder today than it's been in the past. It's not quite a collective amnesia, but there's this kind of widespread angst about personal identity. The Polish sociologist Zygmunt Bauman said it this way. He said, traditional societies are like rivers. They take you in a certain direction. So when you're born, you basically know who you're going to be, and you're carried with the current. But in modern or postmodern societies, there's no current. You can choose to go in any direction, or no direction, or shift direction with every change of wind. So we're more like an ocean. So with so much choice, it's not just me who's saying this. All sorts of social commentators are saying that people get lost. Many films explore questions related to personal identity and self-discovery. So, for example, Matt Damon's films in particular, in The Bourne Identity, as one reviewer put it, the amnesiac spy is an existential puzzle, not least to himself. So as it turns out, many people are not certain who they are today, and I'd like to mention very briefly just eight. These are the kinds of people I've spoken to and have read about, and what I'd ask you to do is to think whether you identify with any of them. Can you see anyone here that reflects you? The first is what we might call the self at the crossroads. When I grew up, there were two moments in life to find yourself or to get your identity. One was when you were born, basically. Your parents gave you an identity in the sense that they gave you a name, they nurtured you, they gave you their values and your earliest experiences. And then midlife was a chance to find yourself again, sometimes not in the best sense, in a way that sometimes disrupted other people's lives. According to one study, traditionally we associate the midlife crisis with people in their 40s and 50s, but this period could be reaching people earlier than we would expect. For example, there's something called the thrisis, which is a crisis for people in their 30s. And it's not that they don't get what they want. It's not that they're disillusioned. It's actually that they get what they want. They climb the ladder, but they find out it's leaning up against the wrong building. One author's book put it this way: 30-something and over it. A bit tragic if you're 30-something and you're already over it, but there you go. Cuspiety is a term for those people experiencing angst on the precipice of reaching some particular cusp age, 25, 30, 40, 50 or so on. I experienced this last year when I brought up my half century. In all these cases, the common element, I think, is some kind of disillusionment. And people are asking, who am I when life's basically passing and it's not what I expected? The divided self is another person who's not sure who they really are. Ever since the Industrial Revolution and the trend to living in cities, people have lived their lives in various compartments. You've got the kind of me at home with the family, me at work, me among friends. And this kind of compartmentalization, I think, can lead to problems of self-knowledge. I'm a different person when I'm in these different contexts. It's not quite schizophrenia, but it is a kind of chameleon-like. Which bit of me is the real me, is what some people are asking. The deserted self is when someone loses someone close to you, which can really rock your sense of self. Maybe it's a good friend, a spouse, or a parent. A friend said to me a few years ago, both his parents had died, and he wondered who he was. And that kind of response is not unusual. My own father died in 2003, and he was a kind of storehouse of memories for me. And he was always there as someone who took me seriously. So I would tell him about my ups and downs, and losing him was a blow to my identity, you might say. It's not that his advice was always that uplifting. He was a Holocaust survivor, Viennese, and lived in as a refugee in China for 10 years. So one time I told him about a very difficult patch in my life, and he said, "Brian, things can always get worse." So the deserted self is asking, who am I when I feel deserted by those who know me best? The deflated self is about the person who's really living with expectations and anticipating who they will be in the future. Many women anticipate being a wife and mother. Many men anticipate being a husband and father. And the obvious problem is, and these things are very much closely tied to our identity, you can change your name when these things happen. You end up with dependence when these things happen. The question, of course, is what if Mr. or Mrs. Right fails to show up? What of those couples, as many as one in six, who struggle with infertility? Such disappointments can be dispiriting, if you excuse the pun. The deflated person, then, is wondering, who am I when I'm not the person I had hoped to be? The submerged person, or self, is the one who says, well, my closest relationship isn't exactly enriching me, it's actually costing me. Jennifer Lopez put it this way, I have been in relationships that can make you doubt who you are. Casey Chambers has a song, The Captain, which is a kind of anthem for women in bad relationships. A couple of the lines go, you be the captain and I'll be no one, which is not very cheering. So the submerged self is asking something like, who am I when my partner makes me feel like no one? It's not an uncommon problem. The sandwich self has to do with the idea that people sometimes feel squeezed by their responsibilities. At a certain stage in life, you feel that you've got aging parents to look after, you've got needy children who need your attention, you've got your husband or wife, you've got your home, you've got your career, and so on. And basically, you feel like escaping. The great example of the impulse to escape my life is the current phenomenon, Eat, Pray, Love. Anyone seen the film yet? It's not worth seeing, I'm told. Is it any good? Okay. Someone, one of the reviews I read called it, Eat, Pray, Self-Obsess. It's kind of this woman who finds herself in a life crisis, an identity crisis, and wants to escape, so she goes to Italy to eat, she goes to India to pray, and she goes to Indonesia to love. Now, cynicism aside, many people, both men and women, identify with this impulse to escape the kind of self-imposed pressures on our lives. Who am I when there's no space left for me in my existence? Next is the aging self. And when people get older, the question for them is not who am I, but who was I? And philosophers actually struggle with this question, am I who I used to be? And I just give up at that point. Aging may bring wisdom, but it also brings many less agreeable developments, and I won't spoil your breakfast by going through some of them. The aging self says, who am I when the best version of me is quietly slipping away? Finally, the forgotten self. Let me ask you this. How many of you can name the first name of your maternal great-grandparent? How many of you know the name of your maternal great-grandparent? Hands up. Well, yes. So a pretty small minority of you can do that. So disturbingly, in the passing of two or three generations, no one will even know your name, which is not a very cheering thought, is it? Who does that make me? Who am I when my significance is such that I'm destined to be forgotten? Now, with all this identity angst in the air, what's the solution? Well, we're told the solution in our society is to find yourself, to design yourself, to invent yourself, to define yourself. They're the kind of impulses. So as one philosopher put it, when it comes to personal fulfillment, many of us subscribe to the idea that the self is an act of artistic creation. Or as another sociologist put it, we respond to the instability of our world, of globalization and other factors, by reinventing ourselves. There are three common ways to kind of establish or invent yourself: career, possessions, and relationships. So before I get to what I think is the solution to this messy problem, let's think about them briefly. The first one is this: who do you want to be? This was actually an ad for a law degree. Anyone know the university? I think UWS advertises their law degree this way. Who do you want to be? Notice it doesn't say what do you want to be or what do you want to do, but who do you want to be? People obviously do define themselves by their work, and that makes sense to some extent. It tells you something about a person to know what they do for work. But does my career define me? What if I lose my job? What if I change jobs? What happens when I retire? My job can only really tell me so much about myself. Who do you want to be today is a book title. Anyone know the book? It's actually a book by Trini Woodall and Susanna Constantine. It's about clothes. Who do you want to be today? So the language of identity has replaced that of apparel or attire. A few years ago, there was a Seiko watch advertisement, I don't know if you saw it, which put things this way. It's not your hair, it's not your income, it's not your music, it's your watch that tells you most about who you are. But the question obviously is, do my belongings, the place where I live, does my address, my bank balance, my super, my car, my clothes, my watch, am I my stuff? Is that all there is to me? Jeff Gallup, who was a survivor of serious depression, put it this way. He said, as a community, we know the limitations of material wealth as a measure of true value, but we seem incapable of breaking its grip on our imagination. How much of our life is spent avoiding what we really are, or I might say, who we really are. The science fiction classic, The Matrix, put it this way, when Trinity said to Neo, the advice I think we all need to hear, the Matrix cannot tell you who you are. Now, many of you won't have a clue what that is, but I'll just move on, I think. So possessions don't define you. Career doesn't define you. The third possibility is that my relationships define me. And that makes some sense, doesn't it? I'm a father. I'm a husband. I'm a son. I'm a friend. I'm an uncle. And so on. But as columnist Mia Friedman in the Saturday Herald put it, if you're defined solely by your role as a mum, what happens when the kids grow up? And if you're defined solely by your role as a wife, what happens when your husband leaves? So I think the three main ways of answering the question, who am I, namely career, possessions and relationships, they do have some legitimacy. It makes sense to say that they contribute to my identity. But I think at best they're superficial. Surely there is more to me than my job, my stuff, and even my closest loved ones. So who am I really is the question I'm asking this morning. Well, if knowing who you are is a problem, Christian faith does offer a solution. And it's this: rather than finding yourself or defining yourself or inventing yourself or even knowing yourself, Christian faith offers the opportunity to be known by God effectively. According to one theologian, he put it this way: personal identity cannot be anchored convincingly without transcendence, without someone from the outside telling you who you are. Now, it's not as silly as it sounds. That's how you got your identity in the first place. Your parents effectively told you who you are. Obviously, you have to own and revise that identity in your adolescence. But Leithart is saying, to have a stable self, you need God. Now, we're used to thinking of a Christian as someone who knows God, and that's certainly true. But if you look at the first text in the handout, so at this point, I'm moving away from the images to the handout. If you can turn to those texts, that might be of some help. So being known by God gives me significance. Look at that first text in one of Paul's letters to the Galatians. Formerly you did not know God, but now you do know God. So this is talking about someone coming to faith. Or rather, are known by God. So Paul actually puts the accent not on knowing God, but on being known. Obviously, in any relationship, there are these two sides. And in context, a few verses earlier, we read that God knows those who believe in Christ, and he knows them as his children. So you'll see, in Christ Jesus, you are all children of God through faith. So being known by God does three things for you. They're in the handout right there. Significance, comfort, direction. First of all, it gives me significance. I don't know if you've seen Hugh Mackay, the social researcher's new book, What Makes Us Tick. He says 10 desires that drive us. The chapters aren't numbered. That's deliberate because he doesn't want to put them in any kind of priority. He talks about the desire to connect, to be useful, to belong. And according to Mackay, he puts one chapter first because it's the most important. He says, the most important human desire is to be taken seriously, which he explains as the desire to be noticed, to matter, to be appreciated, to be remembered. All of us are saying, right through our lives, according to Mackay, please recognize me and acknowledge me. And being known by God, friends, supplies this kind of ultimate recognition and acknowledgement that we all crave. It gives my life and self a significance, irrespective of my failings or achievements. And in the most basic sense, we might even revise the Enlightenment dictum, I know, therefore I am, or I think, therefore I am, is what Descartes said. I put it the other way around, I am known, therefore I am. In this case, I'm known by God. And we see this functioning in in another place in the Old Testament, where one of the prophets is talking about certain people who feel that no one's noticing them. They're in a situation of injustice. They're feeling oppressed by certain rulers, and they're in despair. And the prophet says this to them. The prophet says, the Lord took note and listened, and a book of remembrance was written before him of those who revered the Lord and thought on his name. A book of remembrance. There's this lovely picture of God writing my biography in heaven, such that so seriously does the Lord take those who trust in him, in their lives, their selves, that there's a book being written about them, a book of remembrance. So to the forgotten self, God says, I'm writing a book about your life. Being known also gives me comfort. Have a look at the second point in the handout. Being known by God as his child can offer a kind of stable and secure identity, not unlike that which parents hope to provide for their children, which is both cheering and comforting in and of itself. I have a four-year-old. I have actually four children ranging from 24 through to 4. 24, 21, 18, and then 4. So I was playing with my four-year-old in the garden the other day. Hurt my back recently, so the weeds were pretty high, and cleverly disguised amongst the weeds was a rose bush, which I'd forgotten was there. And Toby went to get the ball in amongst the rose bush and scratched himself. Okay, so what does he need? He needs to have the wounds cleaned and then covered in some way. But first of all, what he needs is he needs to know that he is known and loved by his father. So what he really wants is that cuddle from his father, that recognition from his father. So when confronted with that kind of uncertainty and hardship, being known and loved in and of itself can be consolatory. We actually see this in the little group of other texts that I've got in the handout where it says being known by God gives comfort. In the Old Testament, which you may know was written in Hebrew, the verb to know is yada, and it's often translated differently in different contexts. So have a look at the texts. The first one is about the nation Israel sojourning in the desert for 40 years. And God says to them, I cared for you in the desert, in the land of burning heat. And it's literally, I knew you in the desert. God took Israel seriously, to use Hugh Mackay's language. The next one makes the point much more generally. The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble. He protects, is how the English translations put it. But literally it's, he knows those who take refuge in him. And then the last text makes it clear, by the way it introduces the thought. God's solid foundation stands firm, sealed with this inscription, the Lord knows those who are his. So to the deflated self, the deserted self, the aging self, and to any of us in the midst of life's inevitable troubles, being known by God as his child not only gives us value and significance, it gives us a genuine comfort. It gives us soothing consolation. Knowing that I am known and loved by God is an effective source of comfort, and I can speak from experience, when life is tough. So being known by God gives you value or significance. It gives you comfort. The third point, and closing here, is it gives you direction. Just to return to the title of my talk, be true to yourself. Should you be true to yourself? Well, it depends, doesn't it? What if myself is selfish? After all, the abusive spouse, the dishonest friend, the greedy workaholic, the malicious gossip, all of them are behaving in character when they claim to be true to themselves. And I'd rather not be around when they're being true to themselves. So what we need, I put to you, is this. We need a new self to be true to. And that new self is an identity given to us by God and kept safe in him. Have a look at the text again in your notes. The opening words say, put on the new self. And notice here there's a moral identity and agenda attached to this new self. This new self is being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, patience, and so on. It's not that we live morally in order to earn this status, this identity as being children of God. That would kind of put the cart before the horse. Rather, this new identity forms the basis for moral behaviour. And in one sense, the Christian life is about being set free to be your new self. Now, this is nowhere better seen than in what I might call the cross of Christ and the paradox of faith. So at the cross where Jesus died, where God sent Jesus to die, we find this new identity confirmed. So the cross underscores my significance because of the costliness of the sacrifice. That I'm known and valued by God, I learn at the cross because at great cost and sacrifice, Christ died for me. The cross also delivers comfort to each of us because it assures me of God's love. The imperfect love with which I love my son Toby is only a pale imitation. When I feel despondent and dispirited, I remember that I'm known and loved by God and that God proved his love for me by sending his own son to die for me. And as for direction, when I feel self-absorbed and selfish, I remember that I'm known as his child. I have this new identity and I died with Christ and was raised to new life in him. So friends, it all comes back to this defining moment, not just in human history, but in my history, of Jesus dying and rising from the dead. Now, the assumption behind the postmodern approach to defining yourself, finding yourself, defining yourself, inventing yourself, is the notion of autonomy. And it's heresy these days to speak against personal autonomy. The euthanasia debate is really about people's autonomy. Or independence, we might say. Christian faith offers a kind of qualification of this. Autonomy and independence can actually be another word for sin. Christians affirm that we are creatures, not independent, but dependent on our Creator, and actually lost in need of being found. So rather than finding ourselves, Christian faith offers the opportunity to be found. Faith, then, is me confessing before God my independent spirit, coming to him in humble dependence, in a sense, relinquishing myself, despairing of myself, and accepting this gift of an identity from him as his adopted child. But here's the thing that really excites me. The joy of such faith is in the paradox, because in losing myself, I end up finding myself. Have a look at the final text. Jesus put it this way. Whoever finds their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for my sake will find it. Yeah, there's a German theologian from last century, who most of you will know the name of, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He's Kevin Rudd's hero. Kevin Rudd said that Bonhoeffer was the man I most admire from the 20th century. Bonhoeffer basically took the strong stand against Hitler on behalf of the oppressed Jews and others, and ended up paying the ultimate price for it. He was imprisoned just 1 month after being engaged to his fiancée. They're flooding in. he wrote letters and papers from prison. He wrote a poem called Who Am I? In which he feels like people think he's a certain way. The guards think he's quite supremely confident and serene when he comes out of his cell. But inside he's craving conversation and colours and his freedom. And he doesn't know who he is. So basically, to lose yourself is to come to the end of yourself. It's to say, I'm no longer responsible for myself in terms of establishing my identity. Bonhoeffer's poem ends this way. He says, who am I? Lonely questions mock me. Who I really am, you know me, I am yours. It's a prayer, effectively, at the end. So it's a coming to the end of yourself. Usually Christian faith puts it in terms of not wanting to earn your salvation, not wanting to do good works in order to please God, because that's a futile thing in the end, because we can't please God because of his perfection. But here we're thinking of it from another angle. There's a sense in which I give up in establishing myself. Some people do that when they come to a point of crisis. Other people do that simply out of a recognition that there is an instability in their lives that they'd like to remedy. So I just read the questions and attempt to answer, yep? Okay. How was your identity and relationship with your father affected by you becoming a Christian? Well, my father actually became a Christian himself, if that's what the point was. So he was in Vienna. The Anschluss took place where Germany took over Austria. Kristallnacht happened where the Jews were persecuted. And my father and his two parents, just an only child, fled to Shanghai in China. If you've ever seen J.G. Ballard's read his novel or seen the film The Empire of the Sun, you'll know that Shanghai had this this international settlement where people could go. So it was the one place they could go. So 18,000 Jews fled from Vienna and Berlin to Shanghai. He actually became a Christian. He got off the boat. They were very well off in Vienna. Got off the boat. They had first-class passage. They went to the slum where they'd be living, and they were just overtaken with the grief of their loss. And an American missionary met them and wept with them in their circumstances. So he became a Christian. So me being a Christian, if that's what was the point of the question, was not a disappointment or a problem for my father. Another question. Concerning the claim that a Christian is known by God, surely God knows all and knows the atheist too. How can you say only the Christian is known by God? Excellent question, and something that needs to be clarified. But basically, two kinds of knowledge that I'm talking about here. There's God's what we call omniscience. He knows all about everyone at all times. And certainly God knows about everyone. So there's this kind of factual knowledge. But then the Bible and other languages actually talk about a relational knowledge, knowing someone intimately, personally. And there is a sense in which God only knows believers. So Jesus actually has judgment speeches where in the Gospels in the New Testament where he talks about at the final judgment, one way that condemnation will be communicated is to say, I never knew you. So there is a sense in which God only knows as his children in that intimate sense. If you know German, there's a difference in the language, actually. Wissen means to know facts. Kennen means to know someone. And that's the kind of knowledge. So I think the first kind of knowledge, his omniscience, is about his being everywhere. Whereas the second kind of knowledge, the one I've been talking about, his relational knowledge, is about his love, basically. It's about his love. Another question, are comedians taken seriously by their audiences? My first degree wasn't psychology, but I've long forgotten it, so I'm not sure if I can get inside the comedian's head. You might like to look at Hugh Mackay's book. I think he uses some illustrations like that. Talks about how this desire to be taken seriously, to be acknowledged, to be known, does drive all sorts of people. I think I'll leave it there, I'm afraid. I'll pass on that one. In what way is this emptying yourself different to Eastern thought? Very good question again. And I confess I'm no expert in Eastern religion or Eastern thought. But basically my understanding is there is a point of difference between Christian faith and some of the other world religions, in that some of the other world religions agree that you should empty yourself, you should kind of void and forget about yourself, but there isn't this second step where you're given an identity by a personal God who is your father. So that's a big difference, I think. So in one sense, there is an overlap here, that selfishness, I guess, being self-absorbed, all of us know, is a pretty silly way to live. Christian faith and other faiths acknowledge that. But the next step is the thing that makes Christian faith distinctive. Are we only known by God if we have a Christian or Jewish faith? I mean, I've tried to answer that one already. If you take the Bible seriously, the theme which I've investigated over the last few years is like just 20 times in the whole Bible, but of being known by God. But it's at critical points. So, for example, the patriarch Abraham is said to be known by God. King David is said to be known by God. The prophet Jeremiah. And then, interestingly, the whole nation of Israel. And it's actually connected with the theme of adoption. God adopts us into his family, effectively, when we become believers. And the same theme is extended into the New Testament. The text I showed you already in Galatians makes that point. There is this transition in a believer's life. At one time I didn't know God, now I do know God. Or rather, I'm known by God. And then there's one final question. To be an individual, doesn't that mean that you must be known by someone else? How can you know God as an individual? Certainly, I think it's true. We do, and anthropologists are coming to this conclusion. More and more, the defining personhood in terms of what we might call relational anthropology. So you have to be known to be a self. And I think that's true in my experience. Again, I had a very difficult experience when I worked at the University of Aberdeen in northeast Scotland. Apart from the weather, that wasn't a difficult experience. But I came back to Australia, and I'd been overseas for 16 years, and my own sense of self had been seriously rocked by some personal difficulties in my life. When I got back to Australia, I had two friends who I'd known all my life, Frank and Martin. Frank would ring me every Sunday night, Martin would go on bushwalks with me, and there was this sense in which they knew me and reflected back to me who I was. So I think it's true. To be an individual, it means that you are known by someone else. How can God know me as an individual? I'm not sure what that's getting at, to be honest. I think maybe the answer is as our creator. I wouldn't want to separate the two notions we're looking at here of God redeeming us through the cross, giving us an identity as his children and knowing us, and God creating us. And interestingly, in the Colossians 3 text, the new self is still being renewed in the image of its creator. So maybe the answer is God knows us because we are made in his image, which was broken at the fall, Christians believe, and is the source of so much difficulty and suffering in our world, but can be renewed by this relationship we can have with God by knowing him and being known by him. That's it.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.